So I am joined by my guest today, Roslyn van der Werf. Roslyn, thanks you so much for coming in.
Oh, it's lovely to be here, Liz, yeah.
So welcome to Cambridge 105 Radio. You're here to talk about dyspraxia. Now, it might not be something many people have heard of, so can you explain really what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's a neurodevelopmental condition that you have from birth, which sounds a really big mouthful. I'm sure lots of you and your listeners have heard of dyslexia, where it's a really sort of similar condition in the sense it's just part of you and it comes under this umbrella that they call neurodiversity. So you've got dyslexia, dyspraxia, attention deficit disorder, and then also autistic spectrum conditions as well. They all come under that umbrella of neurodiversity. But what makes dyspraxia a bit different is it's specifically about looking at motor coordination problems. So it could be difficulties with ball skills, catching, balance, sensation to touch, doing up your shoelaces as a child, learning to ride a bike, in adulthood possibly learning to drive a car, and also affects things such as planning and organisational skills, which obviously can have a really big knock-on in the workplace. So, but I think not many people have heard of dyspraxia. I know certainly when we were at school, I think the teachers were really, really learning about dyslexia, not giving away our ages, Liz. But I think there's much more awareness now about dyspraxia. And just to make it even more confusing, the Americans call it something totally different. They call it developmental coordination disorder, also known as DCD. And that's what we have to call it when we're looking at sort of the diagnostic criteria. So I think it can be really confusing for families who are navigating possibly health services with their children or teenagers when professionals, some call it dyspraxia, and every now and again in a report it'll be written DCD. So
It sounds to me like it must be quite hard to detect or to diagnose. I mean, how what sort of tests do you do? Is it a case of...
Well, there's very clear sort of set criteria. Essentially, it stipulates that there's usually sort of developmental milestones from birth. So it could be a delay in crawling, or perhaps the child didn't crawl at all, late in walking or speech, those sorts of things. And then there has to be a real persistent difficulty with activities of daily living over time. So, for example, always having difficulty with ball sports or, I keep going on about shoelaces or finding your way, direction finding. I mean, think back to when you were at school. Think about those children who were the last to be picked for PE. I'm sure all of us can think of possibly a colleague or a family member who forgets all their belongings coming out of the house, who's never where they're meant to be at the right time. And really, it's just part of who we are. But it's only worth having the assessment and diagnosis, really, if you are a significant disadvantage compared to your peer group. So, for example, if these issues are causing you a significant difficulty day to day, that's when you should seek help. And just going back to your proper question, Liz, about the assessments, there's no one magic assessment that you can do. We have to use a range of assessments, and they are motor coordination assessments, looking at balance, strength, manual dexterity, all of those fiddly two-handed tasks that all of us need for day-to-day things. And those assessments are standardised. And what that means is, so for example, if I was seeing somebody that was, say, 14 or 15 years of age, I'd be able to see how good their function is compared with a group, if you like, a regular population of 14 to 15-year-old girls or boys. So you get an idea of actually where is that person average, above average, or below average. And we also look at handwriting speed, visual perceptual skills. How good are you judging space, positioning and size, those sorts of things. But obviously very important skills for driving as well.
Do many people have dyspraxia? I mean, I know it's quite hard to generalise, but...
Well, the Dyspraxia Foundation is a national charity, and I'd really highlight that charity. So if anybody wants to have a quick Google of Dyspraxia Foundation, they're fantastic, and there's loads of info on there. But what they tend to say is within a classroom of, say, 30 children, an average classroom, you have 1 to 2 children with dyspraxia, diagnosed or undiagnosed. And in the literature, it does say that there's a higher prevalence of boys than girls. However, I think the researchers currently are thinking that the girls just aren't picked up, because boys, if they're tending to have a bit of a problem or they're not keeping up in the class, it can go two ways. They can withdraw or become class clown, or end up getting into a bit of bother. And if there's a fuss in the classroom, that tends to be highlighted. It's awkward for the teachers, and then they tend to be picked up. But the girls, what's been found, is that they tend to be a lot quieter. And if they get just about getting by, that it's not seen as a problem. However, that group of students probably aren't reaching their full potential.
Now, what's your background, Rosalind? Because how did you get involved with dyspraxia specifically?
Okay. I try and keep it short and sweet. Yes, so I qualified as an occupational therapist back in sort of 1998 and worked at Addenbrookes Hospital, very local to here, for a couple of years in my basic rotation in all different areas. And then worked in a community setting before doing a research project in London. Anyway, I'll cut to the chase of the question. When I was working in Hertfordshire for the Community Care Trust with the district nursing team, I had a referral from one of the GPs there who said they'd got a young man who was having real difficulty getting up and out to work on time. And he'd been diagnosed as having dyspraxia when he was young, but it was having a huge impact on him as an adult. This is probably 7 years ago now. And I remember thinking, dyspraxia? What's this dyspraxia? Because I'd worked in stroke and acquired brain injury. So any sort of movement problem would be more acquired, something that the person had to then rehabilitate from back to sort of normal movement. So I did lots of reading around and took myself on some advanced training courses in it, where then I learned much more about these sorts of things that one has from birth, that are more developmental issues, which was really interesting. And a really inspirational occupational therapist, Frances Beaumont, who would realise there was a huge gap for adults, particularly with dyspraxia, because obviously sort of somebody in their 30s, 40s, 50s plus wouldn't have been picked up at school, very unlikely. But this group of adults were having a huge problem sort of day to day. And so Frances, also an occupational therapist, set up an assessment service using sort of best practice guidelines. And then I started doing some work for Frances under her sort of supervision and guidance. And then when Frances retired, I took on her sort of specialist occupational therapy service, purely looking at assessment and diagnosis of dyspraxia. It was hard, really hard, leaving the NHS. You know, I'd worked in the NHS for a long time, sort of 16 plus years, but this client group really are not being, their needs aren't being met. There aren't the budgets for it. And I think the work that I'm doing now is very valuable.
So tell us a bit about what you're doing. How are you helping people with dyspraxia? What can be done?
Well, essentially, so our little service, Dyspraxia UK, is purely an occupational therapy service. And we provide, I suppose, independent or private assessment for individuals, or work assessments, or for children or students. However, when people ring, we're always really careful to find out what intervention they've had already for the NHS. For children, it's really important, really imperative that parents have been to their GP, or perhaps in the first instance speak to their teachers, children's teachers, find out how a little bit more what's happening at school. But do bear in mind, often teachers have quite limited knowledge about dyspraxia because they've got so many things that they're having to juggle with all the new testing and things. And then we advise people to go to their GP, because also it's really important that we're able to rule out any other sort of neurological factors. So, for example, anybody that's had a head injury may hit the symptoms that look like dyspraxia, so slight clumsiness, forgetfulness, those sorts of things. If they're new symptoms, then it's not going to be dyspraxia, and the GP really needs to sort of to have a look at you. So we'd recommend to go to the GP. Occasionally GPs fund our service if they haven't got anybody to refer on to, and as do employers. But so we have the occupational therapist in your area will have a chat with you to find out really what the key problems are and to make sure our occupational therapy service is the right one for you. And then from there, we'd arrange a suitable time and place to have an assessment. It's quite long. It's about 3 hours, the assessment. We will say allow for a bit longer, bring a sandwich. And don't do anything strenuous afterwards, because the assessments are really fun to do. Lots of moving around, some paper-based activities, and also lots of talking all the time to try and help us as professionals think about the sort of strategies we can recommend and help you move forward. So really, the key to occupational therapy, why I love it so much, is because it's to help people be as independent as possible in their everyday lives. And we're really good at activity analysis in light of your symptoms, if you like, and to give you those sort of solutions.
So can activities help, like, I don't know, memory, brain, you know, just the, is it, I mean, what can help? I mean, can you improve, or is it something that stays the same? Is it just managing it in day-to-day?
Well, it is managing it, Liz, you're right. And I keep going on about the Dyspraxia Foundation website, but you'll see, don't be shocked, there's a huge list of symptoms on that website, and you'd have to be jolly unlucky to have all of them. But it really does present very individually, and obviously all of us live differently at home, and we all have different jobs and relationships and hobbies, those sorts of things. And so what would be difficult for you would be perhaps different for me. But also you've got those common core things that they have in common.
So, I mean, we're going to take a break now for a travel update, because it's 20 to 3, Rosalind, but we're going to come back to you after that, and we can just give some more information. If anybody's got any questions, then they can email in, or, of course, text in. If there's anything you'd like to ask Ros, who's obviously an expert, she's here, she can answer your questions. So you can email studio@cambridge105.co.uk, or we'll be asking you, you know, to give some more details after the travel. I'm here with my guest, Rosalind van der Weer, who is Director of Dyspraxia UK, and we've been talking about dyspraxia. It's not something many people have heard of, so they might be quite interested, because it does seem it's quite general, isn't it? I mean, the symptoms are quite, you know, I mean, I can see how it can really affect you in day-to-day life, but it's quite hard to pin down as dyspraxia, isn't it?
It is. Well, Liz, it's one of these hidden disabilities, and I think that's really why it's just so difficult for people to get the help and support that they need. I think sometimes if people have a sympathetic GP, somebody that's got, to be honest, probably personal experience of it or a good understanding, and you're able to demonstrate how the symptoms are really having an impact on your day-to-day life, then, you know, that's a good way of building a case to get some support. And the other thing is, people with neurodiversity, and earlier on I was just explaining what neurodiversity mean. I use that as a big umbrella term. So if you imagine a huge umbrella with neurodiversity written on the top, and then underneath that umbrella you've got dyslexia, which I'm sure lots of you have heard of, problems with reading and deciphering words. There's dyspraxia, which is more of a movement coordination problem. Attention deficit disorder, and then the more autistic spectrums, they all fall under this huge umbrella of neurodiversity. And you can have something like dyspraxia and be really bright, to have a really, you know, high IQ. Lots of the people that I see are incredibly bright. I do a lot of work here at the university in Cambridge, and I've been into lots of sort of London-based organisations to support employees in their work. But it is more, yes, those sort of hidden elements that cause people a problem.
So how can occupational therapy help? What do you specifically do that can sort of aid people with the symptoms?
Well, I always say that knowledge is power. And the more that you understand yourself, I mean, this can be said of all of us, to be honest, the more you understand yourself, the better equipped you are at getting the support that you need. And occupational therapists, like myself, are actually very nosy people. A core part of our training is activity analysis, and which looks at what are the physical skills, what do you need physically to be able to do everyday tasks, and what, if you like, motivates you to want to do them in the first place. And half of the occupational therapy training is a bit like physiotherapy, really, all the physical stuff. And the other half of occupational therapy training is psychology. And so we're very well placed. We're very practical types. We're very well placed at being able to really pinpoint what is causing you a problem in terms of your illness or disease or developmental disorder such as dyspraxia. But we're very good at breaking tasks down. And so we can grade activities to make tasks achievable. So, for example, in the workplace, if somebody... People usually ask me to come into the workplace if, usually in response to a change that's happened. Someone's had their targets increased, there's a new computer system, the phone system's changed, they've been sat next to the photocopier and the walkway to the toilet, so they can't concentrate and are distractible. Sometimes I think my job isn't rocket science, but then I think actually there is a lot of skill in being able to really unpick all of these factors to make the good recommendations that can make life easier.
Mm-hmm. And it must be lovely being able to help people directly, and individuals, you know, must be very grateful, I imagine.
Well, I mean, I hope so. I mean, this job, I really love it, and I'm a people person, and I meet different people every day, and people never cease to sort of amaze me, really. And I think the sort of perseverance and the determination that I see people in very high level positions who have often got an extremely talented secretary or PA who do lots of the organisers, lots of the paperwork, lots of that stuff that my clients can't often cope with, allowing them to do what they're really good at. So if you like, lots of the adults I see have themselves, because they're bright, have got their own strategies in place, and it's if something's happened just to upset that balance, we get involved. And similarly with the students, sort of at GCSE time, sort of age 13, they do their options, and the workloads really ramp up, particularly with handwriting, or people not being able to finish their questions in time, because handwriting is often a very common symptom, very painful handwriting, very slow, and not being able to organise your thoughts onto the page.
It's brilliant to know there is help out there. Now, would you be able to give us details of Dyspraxia UK in case anyone's interested and they want to have a look or get in touch?
Yep, absolutely. So, yes, please, any feedback on our website would be greatly appreciated. So it's www.dyspraxiauk.com, and dyspraxia is spelled dyspraxia. So that's dyspraxiauk.com. And please also look up the Dyspraxia Foundation. You can just Google Dyspraxia Foundation. They're based fairly locally, actually, just in Hitchin. And they're the national charity, and there's loads of free resources on their website, and the leaflets are really nicely produced.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Rosalind. I've really enjoyed listening to you and learning a bit about dyspraxia because, again, I was very naive and, you know, like most people, hadn't really heard about it. But now I feel a little bit more knowledgeable. So thank you ever so much for coming in and chatting. And if anyone wants to listen to that interview again, it'll be available on our podcast on our website, which is, of course, cambridge105.co.uk.